Welcome to Shitco Talks, the no-nonsense cycling podcast. Welcome everybody to this second season of Shitco Talks. This season comes with many novelties. One of them is that we'll have international guests in this podcast. Last year, we started with a special guest coming from Spain, Aitor Viribay, nutritionist at Ineos Grenadiers. And this time, I wanted to invite also someone very special. Also, given that we are going to start with this international guest, we are here with Stephen Saylor. I think that Stephen doesn't need any kind of introduction, any kind of presentation. Everybody knows him. But if there's someone who is a little bit lost, Stephen is currently professor at the University of Agder, Norway. He's a very prolific researcher, in my opinion, one of the biggest researchers in endurance sports physiology in the last decades. And he has also been a consultant for several endurance teams, such as the UNOX cycling team in Norway, and professional athletes, and also brands such as Adidas. Many, many thanks, Stephen, for accepting the invitation for this talk.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
So I brought Stephen here to talk about several topics regarding endurance sports training and specifically cycling. Some of the research that Stephen has performed is related to training volume and intensity, and also external and internal load metrics. So I would like to address these topics because I think that he has a lot to tell us. So first question, Stephen, since the start of the century, we have seen many new advances coming into the field of cycling. We can talk about the power meters, which have brought the opportunity to monitor external training load. We can talk about nutritional advances also in the means of carbohydrates, increasing amounts of carbohydrates in training. And this has also changed the training interventions, no? And here goes my question. Which have been, in your opinion, the biggest advances that we have had in our field in these last two decades? And what kind of changes they have brought in the way we are training the athletes?
Well, obviously, being able to measure power has been a big change, and that is in, but that's very specific to cycling. So we have to remember that, you know, most endurance sports, you can't measure power like in the same way in the field, but in cycling we can. And so I think that's had quite a bit of impact. However, I also believe that the top teams, we see that they understand a lot more about balancing training stimuli and fatigue. You know, and they are reducing the number of races that the athletes do. They're a bit more careful to give them some periods during the season where they can go back to normal training. So there seems to be a better understanding of the fact that you have to keep your athletes healthy. And so that's, I see that in the data and in my discussions with teams. Of course, nutrition in cycling has had a huge impact. I mean, we're seeing dramatic changes in the amount of carbohydrate intake, and kind of changing the assumptions about how much carbohydrate can be taken on, rewriting the nutrition books in a way, you could argue. So that's not my key area, but when I talk to pro cyclists, they say the nutrition has been a really big change.
Do you think that current athletes are much healthier than what it was two decades ago?
Yeah, I think at least we see that professional teams understand that their biggest resource is their athletes, that they're a team of 30, you know, that's the typical size of a World Tour team, and that they have to distribute that load. At any given time of those 30, they're going to have athletes that are sick, injured, over fatigued, and they're, you know, so they have to be constantly managing that resource, which is their team. So I do think that there's a better understanding of that. And of course, the behaviors of the athletes have also changed. You know, they think more about being a 24-hour athlete in the sense that, you know, sleep, nutrition, stress recovery, and so forth. So it's not just the teams, but the athletes also understand this process better.
Okay. And related to this, one of the ways to improve athletes' health is to monitor his training load. Yesterday, precisely, I was reading your chapter in Inigo's Mujica's book about training, where you talk about volume and intensity in endurance sports. And here goes my second question. Which is, in your opinion, the most important one? I know it is not a yes or no answer, of course, if you had to choose one, at which parameters would you look at to decide? For example, there are people who have not a lot of time to train, so maybe in those cases you will prefer to choose more intensity versus volume. What's your opinion on this topic?
Yeah, well, I always start with frequency. Is just say the first thing you have to do is establish a habit of training. So if it was your mother and you wanted to get her off the sofa and she wants to run a 10K in a year, the first thing you're going to say is, well, Mama, let's agree on how many times you're going to get out the door. You're going to put your running shoes on. You're going to put on your, you know, the kit I bought you, the warm-up suit or whatever. And then she says, well, okay, I can do that 3 times a week. And so you're going to try to establish that habit with her of getting out the door and just doing something. And then slowly the something, you'll stretch it out. And then only after a couple of months would you start talking to your mama about intensity, right? So and we've learned that from top athletes. We've learned that from endurance athletes, is that the most important thing is consistency. That they are able to stay healthy and they're training very regularly. I mean, I'm just looking at data from a absolute world-class, you know, Grand Tour winning athlete and looking at their training in a February month, and it's 94% low intensity, green below the first threshold. You know, and this athlete 5 months later or 6 months later is winning big events. So I think that's what we see, is that intensity is the top of the pyramid. It's not the bottom. The bottom of the pyramid is frequency and volume, is being able to. Now, that frequency and volume for recreational athletes is going to be a lot lower, but that's still what you're trying to make sure that you're defending. You're saying, I'm going to get out those 4 days a week. I'm going to keep my consistency going. And if that means I have to reduce the amount of hard training so that I recover, I'm going to do that.
Yeah, one of the main topics of your research, which I have read a lot, is that data from the analysis of top athletes shows that in endurance sports, they normally train a lot, mostly quite easy, and with very specific bouts of high intensity, no? Which is what you're talking about. Would you still apply this to people who have very little time to train?
Well, you know, if it's somebody that only trains 3 days a week.
Yeah, the typical weekend warrior.
They only train for 45 minutes, you know, then they can do a lot of things wrong, and they're not really, they can't get overtrained because they're just not training enough. And they have a day of rest between each workout. So pretty much they can do whatever they want. But what's going to happen is if they train the same way all 3 days, they'll stagnate pretty quickly. So even with the 3 day a week athlete, I would try to have them do one of those workouts, have it be more extensive, longer, to use the effect of duration on the adaptations. And then I would have one of the workouts be more intensity oriented, something like an interval session. And then probably the third workout would be more just in the kind of in the middle. So even with a 3 day a week athlete, I would try to use both intensity and duration in a way that creates variation for them. It's not the same every day, and the stimuli are a little bit different. And then clearly we see if an athlete's training maybe 7 or 8 hours a week, for sure it makes a difference. Already with that kind of volume, that if they get the intensity distribution right, if they make sure easy stays easy and hard is hard, they tend to get better. We just see it time and time again. So I would say that we can still learn from the 25-hour a week type athletes, even though we're only training a very small part of that. Because what they show is discipline, making sure that they work their plan. You know, if my plan today is a 2-hour easy ride, then I'm going to achieve that. I'm not going to just turn it into something else as soon as somebody passes me on the road. That's the typical recreational rider, right? As soon as somebody cycles past me, here we go. I'm racing, right? I was going to just do an easy ride, but now my brain just went whoop, you know. So that's what we see is the best athletes have better discipline up in their head.
And that's an important take. You have briefly mentioned, I know this is an off topic, overtraining syndrome. Do you, I don't know how to formulate this question. Do you really believe in overtraining syndrome as it is stated in science? Do you have seen any cases?
Yeah, I have. I've seen athlete careers end because of a very clear overtraining syndrome. Now, do I understand it all? No, but I have definitely seen it. It's rare. I don't think it happens very often now. I do think that science has come along and the coaches are better. The athletes are better. I mean, the whole system is better at being careful, but it still happens. And I have seen it. It was about 10 years ago, but I can, a very specific athlete, I saw it up close and personal, tried to help. And ultimately that athlete retired.
In case anyone wonders, we are talking here about months of rest without returning to previous level.
So it's I would say it's very rare.
Yeah.
And that's good, you know, obviously. But overreaching and stagnation is not rare at all. It's in fact, I would probably say that's very, very common. Yeah.
That's where my question comes from, because I'm younger and I haven't seen any case of overtraining as it is stated in the literature. So I was wondering if in your case was okay.
Right.
That's an important take also. Okay, we have mentioned briefly power meters and their role in the training process. And here I would like to talk about internal versus external training load and, you know, the impact that power meters have had on the second one. Do you believe that power meters have been a game changer in the world of cycling?
Yeah, it's hard for me to say if the, you know, game changer is a big word, but definitely I think it has changed the way they cycle. When I speak with athletes, you know, any top cyclist will be very aware of their power outputs. They're getting that feedback in races. It's one of the few variables that are allowed in races at the world tour level, meaning that, you know, they're not allowed to measure glucose or blood pressure or heart rate, you know, a lot of things that maybe they could, core temperature. So power is one of their main feedback, heart rate and power. So I think it has had an impact, but the problem is that some of the riders have decided that, well, I don't need to measure anything internal. I can forget about heart rate, forget about perceived exertion. I'm just going to train to power. And that I don't think is a positive development.
Would you ban power meters from competition?
No, I don't think I'd ban them. I understand there has been discussion about it. It would make the racing more predictable. I mean, less predictable. It'd make the racing more interesting because now athletes are so tuned into their powers, you know, their threshold powers and so forth, that they're racing kind of somewhat constrained by that. But I think we still see great racing. I mean, good grief, we've never seen better racing. than we have these days. So I don't think it's hurting race.
I think that this has been overstated in the media, because in the end, when you work with pro cyclists, normally, well, you have more experience than me, but normally you will see that they can, even in the absence of a power meter, they are very great at knowing the rate of perceived exertion and the objective. So right. I think that this wouldn't change as much as people believe it would, no?
No. Anything you do 25 hours a week, you know, you get pretty good at it.
That's a nice summary for the title for the podcast. Eh?
So yeah, I agree with you 100%. They know their bodies extremely well. But the power gives them a calibration. Heart rate can give them a calibration to check and see. And that's where this thing about being able to both measure the external power, the external work, and the internal, trying to have some calibration of saying, well, how is my body responding to that same 350 watts or, you know, and when I use 350, for most of us, that would be something close to our maximum 6-minute power. But for these athletes, it can be something close to their first threshold power. You know, and that's the facts. That's how much better they are. You know, 350 watts is the first. Now they finally start to produce some lactate. They go from 1 to 1.6, you know, and now they're at 340, 350. So, and I, you know, some of the guys I've talked to, that's where they're at. And so obviously, but also they get tired. Also, they have bad days. Also, they have to pay attention. And then they're going to be looking at perceived exertion. They're going to be looking at heart rate. How am I, you know, are the brakes on? Is my body in need of a day of rest and things? So I do think that we need to measure both, you know, internal, external.
I know this is a weird question, but I want to know your take about this. If you had to choose one single metric to train somebody, which one would you choose? Power, heart rate, blood lactate, perceived exertion?
Probably perceived exertion. If I only had one and I had to use that every day, then I would want to make my athlete learn their body, you know, and really understand. Because when in the final outcome of it, that's the best device they have is their brain. So I would still be, and the research still indicates that the brain is sensitive to these small changes that say I'm getting tired, and those changes come earlier than hormonal changes, or even, you know, heart rate can go up and down, so it can be confusing. You know, you can manage to hold powers for days, but it's getting tougher, you know, so I still think perceived exertion is a really important tool.
Yeah. As an example, in one of the previous episodes, I interviewed the female world champion in trail running, and she told me that she basically trained based exclusively on rate of perceived exertion. I know that in trail running, we have several problems to monitor, for example, power output, which is an attempt now, but still in the early phase. But yeah, so I think that...
And think about Kenyan runners and Ethiopian runners, and if they have a heart rate monitor, that will be about the most advanced piece of equipment they will have. But most of the time they're going on feel. So we know that they're breaking world records doing that kind of thing. So it's clearly possible.
Okay. Last question, Stephen. I think that endurance training comes and goes in trends. So for example, I remember several years ago we had a huge trend of high intensity interval training and the, you know, the race of CrossFit, etc. In the last 2 to 3 days, years, especially after COVID, I have seen like a huge rise in zone 2 training, this low intensity training, many people talking about it and many studies performed on it. Do you really think that it's just another trend, or is it really that magical, or is it just in line with what you have provided in your previous studies that show that, you know, the volume at low intensity is really the key to performance? What's your take on it?
Well, yeah, you know, Inigo Milan has talked about zone 2. In my world, zone 2, the way he describes it, is still in that under lactate threshold zone, but it's a you're basically saying that the green zone or that area, you're pushing up a little bit closer to the first threshold. It's not a super clear definition for me where zone one ends and zone two begins, because I don't believe there's a very clear physiological definition of the distinction, but they're both in that aerobic low lactate region. So in that sense, it's a positive message. The only problem might be that some people are going to interpret zone two that they say they have to be really up next to the edge of their threshold, and then they go over. Because when athletes make a mistake in training, it's almost always that they push too hard, not that they go too easy. Does that make sense? Recreational athletes, they don't hit the wall. They don't stagnate because they go too easy. They stagnate because they go too hard, and then they don't recover, and they have other stresses in their life, and they just kind of stagnate, doing lots of short, hard workouts.
You have mentioned threshold, because we have like 3 or 5 or 11, even 7 zones definitions. Do you really believe in these thresholds, or we are just talking about physiology as a continuum?
No, I mean, definitely you can measure pretty clear breakpoints physiologically. Now, they're not exactly precise, but they're a bit fuzzy. But they're if you're good at doing your testing, and if you have athletes that are fairly well trained, they can be quite precise, quite clear. Now, if you're testing untrained people, or if people that aren't very well trained, they've been doing a lot of mixed intensities, what we see is they do not have that very clear, flat portion of their curve. They tend to kind of just go up from the start. But if their intensity discipline gets better, if their low intensity stays low, and that, then in a period of 6 or 8 weeks, their profile changes a lot. And it starts to look more like the profiles of elite endurance athletes, not the absolute watts, but the shape. So I do think that it's more about the clients we have. You know, that if you test well-trained athletes, man, it's just really, it can be just so clear, those breakpoints. But it's because they have really good metabolic control.
Well, this is very interesting. So would you suggest using different protocols when measuring gas exchange or lactate in highly trained versus moderately or untrained subjects?
Well, I would, in some ways, I would say, well, I'm not going to do a lactate profile on a beginner athlete, someone that hasn't done anything. I'm first going to kind of get them down the road, 6 weeks of training, try to get them to train just really easy at first, you know, do a little bit, get their, just start getting past that initial phase, because until we get some training in their body, it's like that lactate profile just doesn't tell us much of anything.
No.
Does that make sense? So they're just not ready. Their musculature is not ready. We don't get a good picture. And basically the picture we get is they don't have metabolic control. Everything turns on as soon as they go out the door. And they don't have that flat phase. So that's really the first thing I want to see is, can I get this athlete to the point, or this person that started training, so that we can actually find a baseline, find an intensity where their lactate stays low and their heart rate flattens out. Those are my two. I want to see that flat heart rate, which means, hey, I've got it under control. I'm in a steady state situation. That doesn't happen when they first start exercising, but it comes within 6 or 8 weeks. We start to see it.
Okay, will you say that this first visible adaptation to training occur after 6 to 8 weeks?
I mean, you see some things almost immediately, but you start to get they get into a habit. Their bodies start to show some adaptations. The initial soreness phase goes away. You know, they just, I think 6 to 8 weeks is a good starting point that now we're ready to really train.
Okay. Yeah,
that
totally.
Makes sense?
That's perfect explanation.
But the first, the first 6 to 8 weeks, you really shouldn't try to do interval training or anything like that. You should mainly just get the body used to that, you know, because it's a huge change to go from not doing anything to an hour running or an hour cycling.
Yeah.
Right? That's a big change. So let's do that first.
Okay. All this conversation evolved around low intensity training, the importance of volume. And in several of your papers, I have seen that this has a huge limitation, which is if you want to perform lots of training hours at low intensity, you need motivation. And yeah, and this, I would like you to provide like one, two or three bullet points to keep, you know, like to keep in mind for the amateur athlete who wants to increase his training hours, you know?
Right. Well, it's everything we've ever seen about doing anything well is the process has to be enjoyable. And so one of the things we see is that, when I talk with elite athletes, they say, yeah, you know, we train hard, but we also have fun. And especially on our long rides, we'll stop for coffee. We're laughing and talking to each other. So there's some camaraderie. There's a social environment. Those long, easy runs, you can talk to each other. You can enjoy the environment around you because you can be distracted. That's one of the nice things about low intensity work is your brain doesn't have to zero in and focus on everything that's happening in your body. It can be looking out and seeing the green grass and the spring flowers. So, you know, when I hear from these wonderful athletes like Kipchoge or Kylian Jornet, they are tied into the environment. They love the nature that they're getting to train in. They see that as a joy, that they're allowed to be out in nature often. So I think that's one of the things I would encourage our recreational athletes to think about is enjoy it. Enjoy being outside or whatever you're, you know, that environment you're in. Don't just think of it as work. Because even the best athletes in the world, they don't think of it as just work. They love being outside and being able to do what they do.
Okay.
And there are some hard days, yeah, of course, but all the days can't be hard.
So a good advice would be do whatever you want, but that must be something that will keep you training in the long term, no? The concept of adherence.
Yeah, I think endurance is not just endurance physiologically, but it's a long-term, you know, it's a long game. Hopefully, I'm going to still be cycling when I'm 75 years old. I'm still going to be using my body, I hope, if I live that long. So that means I have to think about how to make it long game, sustainable, right?
Perfect. I think that's a very nice summary for this conversation. Again, many, many thanks, Stephen, for accepting the invitation. For me, it was a pleasure to have you here, and hope someday we'll talk again in my podcast.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you for the good questions.